following program is brought to you by Susty Party, an online party supply store for eco-friendly party products and biodegradable compostable tableware. For more information, visit sustyparty.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to the food scene on heritageradionetwork.org. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkel, here today, hoping not to talk too much turkey, because there's so much more to say with Chef Matthew Leitner from Aterra, New York. Thanks for being in the studio.
Oh, thank you.
Excellent. So we will touch a little about the big bird later on, but, I mean, we've had such crappy, you know, Thanksgiving meals in the past and such dried out turkey that we have to set a foundation for understanding of technique before. And you're a Midwest boy, grew up in Nebraska mainly, cooked around there. What was food like then? What was a Thanksgiving for your family?
Well, I think Thanksgiving then, you know, was a celebration, getting everyone together, roasting a turkey. Usually my mom's stressing out the entire day. But for everyone else was mostly trying to think about what we're going to have for leftovers. And leftovers made the, you know, the dried turkey breast into a good stew that was nice and moist. And so, and you, I still hear that a lot. I hear that a lot of people like, oh, yeah, we have to have turkey, but then we have to have leftover day.
So thinking that day ahead.
Yeah.
I mean, it's kind of like working in a restaurant, too. It's not like you're picking up a dish, you know, creating it without mise en place. It's kind of like cooking on the line.
Yeah, that's
true. You prep yourself out. But, you know, Thanksgiving, when did you start cooking your own? When did you get behind the stove?
To do the turkey?
Yeah.
Wow. I still don't even know if I actually do the turkey. working so much, and then you kind of get there and you just put in your input. I don't know if it's always good. Just like, no, put more butter on it. No, brine it. And then usually just sit there and watch football. But no, probably, you know, once I left Nebraska, and depending on where I worked, because some places that I worked at were open for Thanksgiving. And then probably just recently, I've been able to have a job where we've been closed for Thanksgiving as well. So probably within the last 5 years, started really developing, you know, our own style of cooking turkey.
Was it things like that, those family meals that interested you in food, or were you just fascinated about cuisine from a young age?
Well, I first really got interested in cooking just because of the level of entertainment. I don't know, remember how many times, like, being either on my dad's side of the family and everyone's together on my mom's side of the family. And, you know, we're sitting at home and everyone's kind of, you know, bored. And it's like, well, what are the kids doing? And then we'd go out, you know, and then they'd be like, well, let's have some drinks. Let's eat some food. Let's enjoy ourselves. And that whole idea of entertainment, you know, really intrigued me.
Yeah. And we'll talk about Aterra eventually because it is a mightily entertaining restaurant and concept. But, you know, to entertain your palate, the Midwest, Nebraska, other places that you live don't have the most vivacious palates, per se. We were talking just before about things like chicken fried steak and, you know, the stock of 80s supermarkets. How has your palate growing up there changed, or how has it informed how you cook now?
Well, I think, you know, I feel like I've been fortunate enough that I got bored. And I wanted to really try different things. Too many times that, you know, you'd hear other kids like, oh, we traveled here and this. And then through books to really see like all these different cuisines. Oh, they use these chilies. They use these kind of beans. They have these crazy stews, these crazy flatbreads. And I think my brother and I, we used to always like sit at home starving, you know, bored. And be like, oh, what are we going to eat? And then we'd be like, oh, television, you know, either the Food Channel or some kind of travel channel that would be showing all these different worldly cuisines. And we're like, man, what are we doing here right now? We got to go try these things. So I always kind of really wanted to build my palate. I always thought that was going to be key into learning how to cook good food. You like they always say, you have to, you know, eat good food before you can actually really cook good food.
Yeah.
So kind of that was a passion of mine.
So you ate good food growing up because your father worked for a certain purveyor of hot dogs.
Yeah. you know, working up Midwest family, very typical, parents having multiple jobs. We basically ate out of as quick as we could and out of necessity, like, okay, well, we have 15 minutes to eat dinner. What can we do? What can we have? So we didn't really have the, you know, too much of the huge dinners every single night, even though my mom, she was always raised to be at home to eat dinner, and her mom would always make dinner every night. Either her father liked it or he didn't matter. My grandma would always cook. And so my mom felt like she had to do the same. So she always had about, you know, 5 to 10 like standby recipes that we'd always have. And sometimes, like, you know, 2 or 3 days a week, we'd have chicken fried steak, or we'd have her fried chicken, or, you know, and these were these mainstays that she always went back to, spaghetti and meatballs and things like that. But done at home and done well, that we could all get together to have them.
Yeah. At what point did you, you know, go to school to kind of extend that passion and wanted understanding?
Well, it kind of came, you know, I think going to culinary school for me is different than some other people. I went to culinary school because I didn't want to go to college. I didn't like the idea of sitting down, someone, you know, lecturing and going over things, and you have to take notes and you have to go read a bunch of things. And I felt like I didn't want to spend any time at a desk studying, and I wanted to spend more time doing something physically. So that's kind of, you know, I got really interested in food. I started learning just French food by, you know, getting cookbooks like Alain Ducasse, and really learning about mother sauces. And it'd be like, mother sauces? And it's like, cuisines have laws and systems about the sauces and the preparations, what they do. And I thought it was just completely mind-blowing for me. So I was like, was sent out to kind of really understand that and learn that.
Yeah. It seems like that's a point where things turn and you realized, like you just mentioned, there are systems. There are logistics to cooking. And then initially mentioning that you didn't want to go to college and didn't want to formally educate yourself in that way. I mean, there's such a formal regimen in a kitchen. I always find it interesting and odd that people say, I don't want to go to college because of reason X is usually the reason they get most excited about once they learn food. You had the opportunity to travel with this, to go to Spain, most excitedly, Mugaritz. And I mean, that's a laboratory, right?
Mm-hmm.
How was that kitchen set up and what did you do in there that changed your, you know, mode of thought?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think it's a really funny set of circumstances to not want to have structure, to not being shown what to do or having to sit there and listen to someone talk all day, to wanting to build a kitchen that was maybe more precise than a college, or more precise than a laboratory, or more precise than lots of those jobs that, you know, we think are very mundane. And, you know, I think it started at first as some of my first cooking jobs were, you know, I really love cooking, like working with my hands, but before you knew it, you left work and you were wearing what you had on you. Like, you know, if I was working omelet station, I would have, you know, 30 dozen eggs that for some reason were all over me, smelling like grease. If you forget to wash one, it, like, the whole room stinks. It's like in working through that, I felt like it was a battle. It was like, here is this place that I love food and it's good, but just not a lot of care was taken into it. Yeah, we all loved it. Well, we all thought that the dishes were good, but when it came down to the preparation of it, we just kind of failed in the sense. So actually being able to go to Spain and see a place that, you know, you have a kitchen and there's 40 people working in it, maybe a handful of them are getting paid, and you see just the organization and the structure and the cleanliness. And when I went in there for the very first time and you know, and I probably was in there for, because I had got a very rare opportunity to actually eat there, I think about a week before I started staging there, and I was about as nervous I think I've ever been just going to dinner. And we were in the kitchen and getting introduced to the chef de cuisine, and they're kind of talking about how they work. And, you know, I'm watching like one guy, and, you know, he's like soaped down something like three times in probably the last 10 minutes. You know, it's like it can't get any cleaner. But it was like this drive, like, oh, there always has to be something on it. There is like some kind of film there. We have to at least be doing something to get better and better and better. And you walk in there and no one was touching the food with their hands. You know, they were very carefully either with a spoon or an offset, or with tweezers or in containers. They were very gentle. And it wasn't like they were in a rush to throw things on the plate. They were hovering over each individual dish, like, you know, inspecting it. You know, checking the temperature of the bowl, checking the temperature of the sauce, tasting the sauce, filling that, seeing how many granules or salt are on top. And it was like, wow, it doesn't get much more precise than that.
You know what's kind of fascinating? Because I want to lead into the idea of, you know, Mugaritz, and you spent time in Noma, and even your restaurant now, you kind of toe this fine line of nature versus science. Mm-hmm. This feels like my most Inherit the Wind episode yet, because, you know, we've had this evolution of food, and we draw from nature in this way that it's so expansive and exciting, but simple. And so is food nowadays, but where there's been evolution, there hasn't necessarily been a Darwinism in kitchens, where we have all these new modern techniques and a lot of people go one way or the other, but don't, you know, champion the fact that we now have these techniques and we should be excited and exploring them. At what point in your career did you try to fuse those two things?
Well, in my opinion, I think technique is kind of an interesting thing. Technique, if you know how to execute it and you know it's going to enhance this idea that you have, then it's something that you should try to do. But if it doesn't and you try to force it, you know it. And I think some people just kind of do it and force it and just like, well, this is it. You know, this is what everyone's talking about. This is how we use the technique and I'm using it now. And so I think it should work. And I think that's where we kind of fell in that sense. So, and, you know, it's the idea of, you know, modern food versus classical food, where there was a time when, you know, we talk about, you know, back to chicken fried steak. Well, there was a time where pan frying something was probably very modern. And then they were able to use it and use it on multiple things, but they don't use it on everything. You know, I know nowadays we want to pan fry everything or deep fry everything, but the things that work, we all know. And that they all are like those staples. And the same thing goes down with modern technique as well. And yeah, there should be a lot of experimentation because I think it kind of pushes the envelope. And it just pushes, in my opinion, what it pushes me is the mindset. The mindset that there should never be maybe just a set recipe for an ingredient or a classical preparation that you saw, well, this vegetable is used in this part, region in France or in Italy, and so I think we need to put, you know, tomatoes, anchovies, and things like that with it as well. And to try to take that more of the modern mindset of that and trying to erase some of these old recipes and stuff and to really look at a product almost at its bare state is something that we try to do. And then if it helps us execute when we get this idea in our head of like a texture of a tomato should feel, or a texture of watermelon, or how a broth should feel on your palate, or things like that, and we want to use technique to enhance those. If it works, then yes, you know, that's important.
Yeah, so it's never technique first, then texture afterwards. It's
well, yeah, I mean, I think it just depends.
Yeah,
I think sometimes it is technique. Sometimes you do something, you know, like cooking a pizza in a wood-burning oven, you know, it's technique, and then ingredients come and stuff like that, and you put it together, and it's amazing. So it's just that depends. And some dishes can evolve around that, and I think when you do a big tasting menu that you have the ability to do that. I have ability to do maybe something that's derived around a technique, but usually at the end it's about this almost innate feeling that we have when we eat and the sensations that we have while we're eating them. And we really try to look at that with the food when they eat.
Excellent. Well, we're going to take a quick break, come back, and not necessarily go step by step, but do a progression through your tasting menu currently at Aterra. You've been listening to The Food Scene on heritageradionetwork.org. We'll be right back.
And I'm Jessica Holsey.
We are the entrepreneurs behind Susty Party. Susty Party creates responsibly made, eco-friendly party supplies and compostable tableware. Parties and events generate the second largest amount of waste in the USA, just behind the construction industry. Susty Party products make parties more sustainable and sustainability a little more fun.
Susty Party plates, bowls, and straws are available in Whole Foods retail stores and also at sustyparty.com. We offer a curated selection of other Susty-approved party supplies. We also have a commercial division, Sustyware, that sells compostable tableware in bulk to businesses and food service industry establishments.
Susty Party is a certified youth trade company and B Corporation. Our social, economic, environmental, and even spiritual values drive Susty Party to live our motto,
respect Earth and party on.
Hey, and welcome back to The Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkel, here today with Matthew Leitner of Aterra Restaurant here in New York. I'd love to talk about your tasting menu because the uniqueness of Aterra is that you come in and have, what, a 15-course progression, a meal that you don't really get to pick or choose, but which kind of chooses you. What's going on today? What's on the menu, Chef?
Well, today, you know, we do about 15 dishes, and beforehand we do about 10 different snacks, and we do a couple different little treats at the end. So it just really depends. I mean, we're kind of getting into a season, and it's been a little strange this season so far, but kind of moving more towards into the fall.
Yeah.
So, you know, we start taking into account how people feel when they walk in the door. Traditionally, you know, it's cold, it's windy, you want something warm, things like that. So as that starts to change, we start to change kind of our mindset of what we want to do and what we want to kind of give people first. But right now, tonight, we'll have guests come in. And when you get into Aterra and it's just blank, you know, it's just a concrete bar, you go up there, you sit there. There's no water glasses, napkins, nothing. So you kind of walk in there and it's a little blank, and it does for a sense kind of feel cold, but it's supposed to almost kind of give you this start of like, okay, well, what's coming? You know, there's no hints to anything. You can't really start guessing too much unless you're online, of course, because everyone takes pictures of everything nowadays. So and then it kind of starts, you know, and we'll start something you know, crunchy or soft. And, you know, I think Aterra is kind of a place of seasonality and a place of some luxury as well. So, like, we do a meringue that we use, that we froth beer and we dehydrate it, and then we serve it with caviar as your very first thing. And we'll pair that with a beer cocktail that we find is kind of fun, refreshing, but at the same time, something familiar. There's a little cream in there, almost like creme fraiche. The little bitterness of the hops in the beer tend to go very well with the caviar. And it's just very, very fun way texturally to kind of get things started. And through that, you'll start to see a different progression of some different snacks at times. Like right now, we have sunchokes in. We cook them for a few hours. We fry them. We fill them up with the pulp on the inside with all kinds of different herbs and flowers. And they have these really, really special texture that you'll get from a vegetable that it's a little bit more difficult than most vegetables just because they're so high in pectin, almost kind of like a rind or a pork skin. And then we'll move on to, you know, some more fun things. You know, we do a razor clam, which is basically like a saltine cracker that looks like a razor clam filled with an aromatic cream of razor clams. Just kind of a fun, playful thing, just to give people something to look at, let them, you know, discover it for themselves and enjoy it. And, you know, at the same time, too, not take it too serious.
Yeah.
And just enjoy it. And then we'll move on to some different things. So right now we're kind of playing with the ideas of once we start getting into different courses, plated courses, we'll go through the snacks and you'll sit down and you'll have almost a placemat come out and, you know, your silverware start coming out. And then all of a sudden it's like it starts forming. You don't really have the idea that, well, maybe it'll just continuously be like this, or maybe there will actually be a little bit more traditional. And that's something we're trying to work on a little bit too. How do we continuously take apart some of those rules of almost rules of engagement when it comes to fine dining, and to maybe possibly you can sit down and have spoons and knives and forks that come out and you don't really know that they're there because you don't present them as a piece, but they come out just before the dish and the dish goes down and there's not too much thought about it, you just eat it. That's something we're trying to experiment with a little bit more on. But right now we try to work with a couple things. You know, we try to work on with the idea of having something hot and luscious, and then maybe jumping into something that's cold, a little bit off. Like in summertime, you want to kind of work your way into something kind of cold and refreshing to cool you down, and then work into hotter dishes where we feel like it's kind of a fun time to let's get people warmed up, let's get them kind of into it, and then let's back it off a little bit, let's cool them down, let's make things a little bit subtler, and then go into more broth courses or vegetable courses and things like that. And it's been kind of an interesting thing. It's almost like a break, but it's not. The flavors are there, but it's not. It becomes more enjoyable because your palate's ready for it.
Yeah. You know, it's funny because you had this restaurant in Portland, Oregon, Castagna, mm-hmm. for a while. Do you feel like there are different rules of engagement for diners out there versus here?
Yeah, I mean, I think... you know, I feel like with this kind of food, it's just challenging anywhere. And it's just up to me and what I'm going to do on a given night, depending on where it's at, and how that's going to affect the experience after, you know, the three and a half hours that you're there. But yeah, I mean, I think for a Terra is different because it's smaller and it has to be eye paced because we're very small. And we don't want people to lose a little bit of that intensity that comes with it, this constant enjoyment and things coming after you. That's what we want this experience to be about. Now, Castagna, on the other hand, was a bigger restaurant. So you had, you know, tasty menus. You had five-course menus, some a la carte stuff. So it was kind of a little bit mixed. So just different in general.
Yeah, so it must have been fascinating to see that kind of breadth of... interactions in a restaurant that had so many facets to it. And why choose a tasting menu? Why hone it on specifically that and make it more experiential and interactive in that way?
Well, a tasting menu is great because then you can start stripping things apart. For instance, we have a dish that's just chopped up lamb, basically, and that's basically it. Now, if you give people a three-course menu and they just get a dish that's just chopped up lamb, they're going to be like, what the heck? You know, what is this? What else is going with it? So I feel like at that point, you know, because of this value perception that you have, you know, your herbs on it or your sauce or your egg yolk and your capers and things like that. But we want people to notice a very specific technique that we do with the tomatoes and the lamb, and then that's it. Because you're going to have something after that. You're going to have another element after that one. All the way through desserts, too.
So it enables you to hone a whole meal rather than just a course. So I don't know, do chefs think composite? Do they think that, you know, this makes a dish, But when you have a tasting menu, you can say this makes a full menu, so you don't have to put your starch and your veg.
Well,
and
yeah, I mean, I think a lot of chefs think composite. I think composite. You know, even like some of the things that we've been kind of criticized about was that, well, only if these dishes were going to stand alone, I don't know if that would work. Well, that's not the intention. If that was the case, it would be a different concept with a different menu and different ideas. So, it's an interesting thing. I've been to have like a seamless somewhat experience, you have to take away some ideas, push back on a couple, and push forward on some other one. So you have this almost seamless quality from the very first thing you've eaten to the last thing you've eaten that really feels as yourself. I mean, considering it like almost like a branding strategy, like here, I want to put something on the menu, but I want it to feel like us. I want it to look like us. I want it to feel like us. I want it to be us. And I want people to realize that without having too much going on.
Yeah. Well, so how do you feel? What do you look like? Explain that a little bit more, because from the images that I've seen, you know, the New York Times review, things are very naturalistic. Some are even monotonic. Like, you're not even necessarily thinking that color is some of the, you know, a large component on the plate. Is there a mantra? Is there, you know, like words to live by?
Well, it's hard to put it together in any kind of words, especially coming from my mouth, because it's, you know, when you're in it and you're looking at it all the time, it's really hard to put a phrase to it or whatever. But for us, it's about subtleties and simplicities and things that are going on that we find beauty in. And that we really try to extract and try to force that and try to push that push the envelope towards seeing that. And it could be something as simple as, you know, looking at some concrete that has, you know, mold on it or something very interesting or textural or almost natural artist art and essentially. And then really just kind of having fun with that and not feel like you can somewhat do that with food. And I'm not saying that we're trying to paint dishes or trying to make everything look like art, but we want people to kind of feel this connection with it. Like, wow, either I've seen something that reminds me of this, or after they're done eating, they will go somewhere and then see something that reminds them of something that they've ate. And I feel like sometimes that gets lost a little bit,
yeah,
with food, and that's something we try to do.
Well, let's talk about the F word, mm-hmm. Foraging. It seems like that same kind of discovery too. You know, you're in the middle of the woods and you stumble upon something beautiful, almost artistic. Is it that same sensation for you?
Yeah. Well, I think it's, you know, foraging is very interesting, and because it's more of a, like you said, it's about finding something. And once you find something the very first time, you notice it everywhere. And that's been one really interesting thing about foraging. It kind of allows you to really kind of open up your eyes and minds and your senses to a lot of things that are going on. It's an interesting part of it. Not necessarily, I think, you know, in my opinion, I think foraging is, you know, interesting and fun. And I think it's a little popularized and for something that's been done for, you know, multiple years, and restaurants using chanterelles and wild herbs and things like that. Remember when I first started cooking in Oregon, we'd have guys coming back with wood sorrel and miner's lettuce and things like that. And for us getting into it, when I first started at Castagna, the whole foraging kind of took place of, you know, this inspiration, this, like, you know, looking at textures, looking at our natural surrounding to really kind of develop what cuisine in a region could be or could feel like. And it just really opened up senses to a lot of different things.
Yeah. Well, how have those senses changed since coming to the concrete jungle?
Well, you know, New York's great in the sense that there are so many amazing farmers, and a lot of people forget that there is a lot of great agriculture, woods, outdoor activities and things if you can get out, which is the challenging part. But, I mean, you can go in 45 minutes, and the same thing in Portland. You can go 45 minutes and be out in the middle of nowhere. You don't see the city or anything like that. And there are people out there who are doing it. There are people who forage specific mushrooms because there are some special ones around here and some very specific things. And the difference between here and there is that here it's just more seasonal. where there you basically have two seasons, and here you will have the whole four seasons. So you just, if what you want to do is forage and do things and call yourself a forage restaurant, which I don't think we should call ourselves a forage restaurant, but we like using unique products, then, you know, you have to learn how to use these very specific things and roots and barks and different stuff like that creatively, if that's what you want to do.
Yeah, what of those ingredients are you extremely excited about? Because I'd like to point out the barks and the roots that you use, too, are throwbacks as well. It's not like you found a whole new tree or a whole new...
Yeah, exactly.
Re-implementing them in really awesome ways.
I mean, sometimes you can look at, you know, different... People have already been using a lot of these things for a long time, and we try to capitalize on some of that. Like, you know, we'll talk about spruce shoots, which they're not in season right now, but spruce shoots have been used in making beer in Canada for many years. It's a very typical thing. So we're like, well, let's work on some kind of a toasted grain broth infused with spruce shoots. And that's almost like a beer kind of thing. You know, and you, that level of creativity comes up because it's somewhat familiar. If you ever had one before, or if you haven't, well, that's a, you know, it's a different story.
But I know you hold a level one or level two or both, you know, something from the Somme Guild, but you do realize how much you like beer, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I drink way more. Actually, for me, I got away from drinking wine a while ago for some reason. I don't know why. I think it's when I moved to Spain. But beer and hard liquor, yeah, you can't really beat those two.
Yeah. So. And they're so pure, too. I mean, the simplicity of what they actually are is kind of the antithesis of a lot of, like, modern chefs.
No, it's true. I mean, if you look, well, you know, even wine... some great wine producers can put very little together and make extraordinary things. But if you talk about like different kinds of bourbons and stuff like that, and the simplicity behind it, and some of the flavor profiles that you get, I was talking to someone. Someone brought me in a bottle of Pappy's, and you know, I was drinking it, and I was like, "Oh, it tastes like bananas and wheatgrass and all." And they're like, "What? How do you get stuff from it?" And it's like, you know. Once you start taking away all these different things and you focus in on that, like, you know, gins or brown liquors or beer, then you're able to, like, open things up. But now if you're like, well, I'll drink one beer a week, or I'll, you know, have a glass of wine on Fridays, or, well, maybe every once in a while after dinner I'll have a bourbon or something.
Yeah.
Then your palate doesn't really open up as much to them, you know.
So has that opened up a whole nother, you know, flavor profile for you? Because, you know, traditionally or not, there's... pairings, and it's been wine, and we've seen it move into beer and cocktails. That must create a whole bunch of other different subsets for you to play with and bring in the birches and bring in the barrels and put those flavors in your food.
Yeah, I mean, we you know, sometimes, you know, it's just about education. The more you learn about everything, the more you understand why they're doing a specific thing to this, and then you ask yourself this question, well, maybe I could use it towards food. Like, you know, we use a, you know, bourbon barrel, and we cold infuse milk in it for about 2 to 3 weeks, and then we make ice cream with it. And that was basically, you know, me reading and thinking about all these barrel-aged cocktails, you know, and kind of going through the process of, well, how do you do it? You know, and if they're dry, you got to fill them with water. And we're like, well, why do you have to fill them with water? Then we'll just fill them with milk. And produces that. So it's just about knowledge and like opening things up, but then using them, you know, in a clever way. It's not like, well, I'm going to use it to age veal stock or something like that, which, you know, it could be good, but just has to have direct purpose.
Yeah. So what kind of ingenuity do you have for a turkey for Thanksgiving?
For turkey? For me, I think it's keeping it simple. I feel like I just want to do a regular brine. I know like a couple of years ago you saw everywhere, like Today Show and all these different places, it's like all dry brine. And I want to do a really good, you know, infuse some spices, salt, and then do a wet brine. And I think, you know, I'll just have to use some space at work so I can actually pull it off and let it sit there for, you know, a couple of days. So we'll see how it turns out.
Yeah, but are you a straight up mashed potato cranberry sauce kind of guy?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, when it comes to doing all of your sides, it's a good time to kind of relive your childhood. You know, my mom used to always make these great egg noodles, mashed potatoes, green bean casserole, pumpkin pie, you know, the staples.
Yeah. So coming from a place that you said had two seasons to one that has four, do you feel like you get that much more to play with?
I feel like it pushes you more, because I think sometimes, like, you know, even that we've been open for a short time, and the first year is always the most challenging, is because when we got open, it was right at the beginning of spring, and spring ended quick, and then it was summer, and so the entire platforms changed. You know, if you talk about spring being bitter and sour, and these are just the normal things that, that coincide with spring, and then you have summer, which is all about richness and umami and sugars and all these like natural sugars, and very savory. And then moving right into fall quickly, you lose a lot of that. And then you also kind of get to this point where, you know, some of the roots aren't quite as sweet as they should be. So you're not quite up to this level of savoriness or umaminess that you talk about in food. So, you know, it's challenging because it pushes you and pushes you fast. And one of the things that we want to live by is that, yeah, we have some fun techniques and yeah, some stuff looks pretty cool, but we want to put ourselves into a situation that, you know, if it's not right and it's not good, we're not going to keep it on. If the product's not amazing, we're not going to keep it on. And it's just, we just need to force ourselves to be creative on the fly, to do whatever we can and try to implement it. So sometimes you'll see fun stuff too, where, you know, it's a very alive process. So you'll see a dish come on and maybe for the first 3 weeks that it's in one stage, and then it starts to change and starts to evolve. And then through the next 4 or 5 weeks, it becomes something else, and then it's done. And what's interesting about that process is because now for the next year, I can sit back and look at that and go, well, what we did after that didn't make it any better or worse doing that, but there was something really special about it. You know, for instance, like, we were working on a thing with matsutakis, and matsutakis are a thing that should definitely be served with themselves, but we were serving them with a piece of meat, and by the time when the dish arrived, the matsutakis were gone, you know? So, but then it's like, well, now we won't have to wait for it next year.
Yeah.
Next year, we'll be waiting for the matsutakis, you know? And then being able to take rigorous notes and to be able to be like that, I feel like that's, in my opinion, innovation, especially when it comes to food, because the products are all the same. Just they come at different times, and then to be ready for that change and to do something interesting.
So it's not so much innateness as it is just being ready and waiting for it again. It's the patience.
Yeah, it's the patience for it. It's the, you know, the sensitivity towards the product. It's the patience for the product. And then it's, you know, kind of that waiting game and kind of what's leading up to it. But when you look at a taste menu like we're doing, it's a bit of an, a Rubik's Cube. So you pull one thing out, you might have the possibility to put 10 things on. But if you put one thing on, you might have the possibility to have to change 10 things. So it's very interesting.
Yeah.
It could be an herb. It could be an oil that we use. It could be a salt that we use. It could be something. And then all of a sudden you change that and want to move that. And then, no, it changes the dish. And then you have to change that. So it's quite the process.
Excellent. Well, season after season, year after year, I can't wait to see this growth and this constant evolution towards a bigger, better, new Atera.
Thank you.
Thank you again for being on the show, Matthew, and we'll have to stop by soon.
Excellent. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to The Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkel, hoping to have you back here next Tuesday at 3. Cheers.
Thanks for listening to this program on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.